At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Ignacio M. Garcia about his new memoir, Chicano While Mormon, Activism, War, and Keeping the Faith, published by Fairleigh Dickinson Press in 2015. Dr. Garcia is the Lemuel Hardison Redd Jr. Professor of Western and Latino History at Brigham University in Provo, Utah, where he teaches courses on U.S. history, Latino history, Latin American history, and historical methodology. Dr. Garcia is also the author of several influential books on Mexican American politics and civil rights, including White But Not Equal, Mexican Americans, Jury Discrimination, and the Supreme Court. Also, Viva Kennedy, Mexican Americans in the Search of Camelot, and Chicanismo, the Forging of a Militant Ethos Among Mexican Americans, and also United We Win, the Rise and Fall of La Raza Unida Party. Dr. Garcia has also published a biography of the very influential Mexican-American civil rights reformer, Hector P. Garcia, and he has also most recently produced a local sports-slash-historical community study of San Antonio entitled When Mexicans Could Play Ball, Basketball, Race, and Identity in San Antonio, 1928-1945. Ignacio, welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Well, thank you very much, David. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it, yes. And I was wondering if you could begin our discussion. You know, this book is about you. It's a memoir. But if you could kind of give us just a, you know, glimpse into who you are and a little bit about your background to get us towards that discussion. I wonder if you could start us off in that way.
Sure. I was born in Nuevo Laredo, Tamaulipas, and my parents came to the States in the early 50s when I was a young child. They were sort of the wave that came after the deportations of Operation Wetback. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. I went to Sidney Lanier High School, then went into the military, came out, went to a small university in Texas, Texas A&I University, which is now Texas A&M University. Mm-hmm. That's followed up by one of the big fish in Texas. And then I studied journalism, was a journalist for a number of years. I covered the Central American and Civil Wars, went to Lebanon during the Civil War there, and a number of other things. And then one day I decided to that I really wanted to be an academician, that I wanted to go into history, went back to my PhD at the University of Arizona, taught for 3 years at Texas A&M Corpus Christi, and then was hired here at the Brigham Young University and been here 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up, you know, very much Mexican-American. Then I became a Chicano in college and remained so since then. And so that's sort of a quick summary of my mm-hmm. life.
Well,
the other part, the other big part, of course, which is part of the novel, of the memoirs, of course, are I'm LDS or Mormon.
Right.
And have been since my mother got converted when she was 15 and baptized in un río, in a river in Monterrey, Mexico. And so I myself found sort of religion when I was about 15 years old.
Right.
And have been LDS since then.
Great. And that gets me right to where I wanted to start our discussion and what is really at the you know, the center kind of what is it? It's not a tension, but it's a seeming paradox, and that is the two identities or two. I mean, all of us inhabit a number of identities, right? But the two of them discussed in this book primarily are that of being a Chicano and a Mormon. And those are two identities that are seemingly incongruent and conflicting, I think, to the public at large, you know, those both either within or outside of the Mormon church, or those within and outside of academe. And I wonder if you could comment just initially, why do you think that is? Why is it, why does, you know, saying one is a Chicano Mormon, why does it strike people as odd?
Well, I think for one is that one looks at Chicanismo as a militant faith among a Latino or Mexican American experience, and then most people recognize that the Mormon Church has been perceived as a very conservative, and has been a conservative institution, and it is, you know, America's religion. It is founded in the country, and so there's a sense that Mormonism represents a lot of things that we Chicanos may have been battling against. And so I think there is that. And I confronted in my early years it was interesting. I confronted this sort of shock and the sort of critique when I was in the Chicano movement who thought that a Mormon couldn't be a good Chicano. So I had to prove that I was a good Chicano activist and then scholar. And then I had to deal when I sort of came into the Mormon world, especially in the academy, was that could I be a real solid Mormon if I had all these ideas and if I was a Chicano? And so in an interesting sense, I've had to prove myself to both communities that are dear to me. Mm-hmm. But they've made me who I am, and in that sense of struggle. Religious people, I think, understand how much life is a struggle and that you don't always fit, and the more different you are. And so I think that was that, you know, that you look at these two communities and say, oh, they can't be, somebody can't be both. But I think Eric Pagan, who did an intro to my book, mm-hmm. lays out in very wonderful detail and discussion how that happens and what it has made me. And then, of course, the rest of the memoir deals in part with that tension.
Right. No, and I agree. I think, Pagan writes a wonderful, foreword to the book that provides a glimpse into that tension, and then we're able to see how that works out throughout the book. And it seems to me, reading through the book, that there are three primary sites where the development of your Chicano and Mormon or Chicano Mormon identity kind of occurs. I mean, you've been in more than three places, of course, but it seems that the barrio that you were raised in, which is on the west side of San Antonio, your experience in the army and particularly Vietnam, your time in Vietnam, is that second space. So the barrio is the first space, Vietnam's the second space, perhaps, and then Kingsville is kind of where the story ends, at least this part of your life, is that third space. And so I was hoping to structure our conversation kind of on those three places. And in beginning in the barrio, I was wondering if you could speak a bit about the influence of your parents on, helping you to, develop a sense of your Mexicanness or your Mexican-American identity during your childhood, which is pretty much covered in the first couple chapters.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, my parents are immigrants. They never mastered the English language. My father works in a restaurant for another Mexican. And he's a waiter for 50 years. And my father has been an activist in Mexico, but he was one of those sort of populist activists that he would tell me whenever he would share. He didn't want me to become a radical, so he didn't always share a lot. But when he did, he would say that when he got paid, he'd go out there and give the un peso to the to the right wing party, and then he'd go and give to each party until it got to the Communist Party. Simply because he wanted to be right with whoever was elected. Mm-hmm. And he was out there, for candidates and whatever. In many ways, my father was a populist, and there were a lot of progressive things. But he was also a man who wanted us to succeed in life. And so mm-hmm. he was always, once he crossed the border, he left us in Mexico mm-hmm. and never became involved in the politics. But his activist blood, and he used to, And he mostly told us about it in a joking manner, so we would all be laughing about the crazy things he did as a political activist. But so I felt like that blood of activism ran in my veins. And I would one day tell him that, and he would just get so upset about it. And my mother was a sort of staunch nationalist, muy mexicana. And while neither one of them was anti-American or anti-gringo, they were very strong in their sense of who they were. Mm-hmm. And so my father was about succeeding and being proud of that which was Mexicano. My mother was a real staunch nationalist, and everything in Mexico and in Espanol was better, without criticizing the other. And so in many ways, my mother would sort of drag us when we were young kids, to these this late September celebrations, mm-hmm. Where my father would walk with us and point all the exiles from Mexico who had, you know, established a business and a farmacia, a restaurant, or whatever. So we were always very conscious, even though we were constantly told to avoid conflict, which is exactly what I would end up doing as a young activist. Mm-hmm. I went to a high school that was almost 100% Mexicano, and so this world that I developed was both immigrant, but it was also very Mexican-American. Mm-hmm. And so my mother was the one who was Mormon, and she would take us to church, and I have a whole section on how much I didn't want to go to church and how,
right.
I was unreligious, though very spiritual in many ways, and her tenacity, which I think a lot of religious parents can relate to, you know, taking your kids to church when they would rather be doing something else, but then finding that later they would appreciate that sort of moral compass they got in their own, you know, denomination or through a spiritual life. And so, and my father was not Mormon, but he was always very proud of his children. He was a Rosicrucian, and so he spirituality was also very important for him. And they were both very much service oriented. And what I didn't always realize that early on, it was when they were both later on in their years, and my father died, and I saw this incredible number of people talk about his service, and my mother, when we took her from San Antonio to go live with my brother in Tucson, I also found out so many people talked about all these little things of service and all the things when my parents had been there to help them, to defend them, whatever. And so I think they were very important, though I didn't always appreciate it when I was growing up, as most young people.
Right.
They don't appreciate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of tension. And early on, you know, like many others, I was conscious of being Mexicano, but I also wanted the American reality.
Right, right.
And so that, but I think they kept me grounded in many ways to who I was.
Yeah, and you mentioned that your father, I believe, you credit him, somewhat apolitical after he immigrated, right? That he was one really instilled within you the love of Mexican culture through, you know, Mexican cinema and television, writing, things of that sort. Is that right?
Oh yes, my father wanted to be able to do all those things, but as a waiter, never being able to afford it, had a second grade education in Mexico. Nonetheless, he loved the idea of accomplishment, and I think sometimes he vacillated from being a populist to being a bourgeois in thinking. But in that tension, we were exposed to, you know, political magazines. I used to read El Siempre, which was a big political magazine in Mexico. At first, I would look at the back because there were some pictures of some very beautiful women, mm-hmm. Young ladies, and none of the cheesecake variety. But there was this, and then eventually I started reading. And while I could not always understand, because my Spanish, as good as it got, was at that time not very good, but I just loved the whole idea of writing about politics and, and struggles and philosophy. And so I always remember that being a big part of my growing up.
And you know, staying in the barrio, you know, and moving maybe a bit. We have the, you know, the influence of your parents, but you also state that, and I think this is in the foreword and it's of the book, and it's reiterated throughout, that your core values were learned in that small Mormon church on the west side of San Antonio, and you refer to the type of religious environment, and it's both religious and cultural environment that you were raised in there, in the San Antonio barrio, as barrio Mormonism. Can you discuss that? Mm-hmm. What you mean by that, and what those experiences entailed?
Sure. In a way, you know, the little ward, we call them wards, branches, congregations that I went to, was right deep in the west side of San Antonio. And so people there had been converted to the Mormon gospel, but there was so little influence from the outside. What we had was a few of the texts and a few of the teachings that had been taught. And so much of what the leaders of that small church did was they sort of navigated the challenges that confronted us as people in the barrio, poverty, discrimination, although we didn't talk about it in that sense, and identity. And so in many ways, what really impressed me initially was how these people made it work. They created an environment in which we felt secure, in which we were able to feel secure about our own identity. And it was interesting because there was this constant tug between the American influence and the immigrant influence, and I saw people, you know, sort of deal with it. They also taught me the kind of religion that is sort of religion on the ground. Cherry Moraga used to say she called it the scholarship on the street. That is that I learned that religious principles were to be applicable to our daily lives in terms of dealing with other people, in terms of being charitable, being right. serviceable. We were not into a lot of, you know, in-depth doctrine. Mm-hmm. We didn't know it. We didn't have the books. We didn't get our manuals on time. And so much of that was people taking a few core values that were contextualized within living in a barrio environment and making it work. And I think that's where I learned to be compassionate, to be charitable, to be proud of, because the pride of who we were came in the fact that God had made us this way. Mm-hmm. So if God had made us who we were, Mexicanos, Latinos, whatever, then that must have been a value. And if there is some value in it, then we have to do something with it. And so I think that... And I think the ability to survive San Antonio and the west side of San Antonio and the problems inherent in you know, what was a barrio that was poor in many ways. And so I think that barrio of Mormonism is a barrio. I learned a theology of action, of work that would serve me well when I myself would one day sort of lead a congregation.
Right. You mentioned earlier too that you know, your mother was baptized. So your mother was baptized when, I think you said, she was 14 or 15, is that right?
Right, correct, about 14.
Right. And then she raised you going to church. Somewhat, I think you said a little bit against your will at times. You said you're very spiritual but didn't always want to, you know, walk the 3 miles to church and back. In your teenage years is when you became much more active involved. It was actually in, I think you said, when you're 15, that's when you were baptized. Your father allowed you to be baptized at that point. He felt it was a choice of yours. So it was in your teenage years that perhaps you began to identify more as Mormon. Is that correct? And if so, what were those experiences and relationships that started to really solidify in you a sense that you were Mormon, you know, you were attaining this identity yourself and religious practice? It wasn't just, you know, the faith of your mother anymore.
Well, what happens is that somewhere along the line, when my mother gets us to the waters of baptism, she herself had been struggling. My father at some times did not want us to be Mormon. He was proud of what we would end up doing, but he struggled with because Mormonism has always been a religion that demands so much. And so there was a tension between, you know, were we committed to the family or Mormonism? And so when we got to the waters of baptism, my mom took a hiatus. She took a vacation, and so she stopped going to church. And my oldest brother initiated. So I was faced almost shortly after I sort of became converted, not only baptized, but, you know, all of us in religious entities have to become personally converted. Once I sort of said, okay, this is, I like this, then my mother stopped going, and so if I was going to go to church, I had to get up and do it. And so then, being there, I began to find mentors and people who understood, because there were a lot of split families there. There was a lot of families in which were only part of the family was Mormon, and so we sort of became closer to each other. And so I found some mentors, men and women, who took me under their wing. And then I just started participating in everything. I became one of these joiners and began to develop my own spiritual experiences, began to look at the way people acted, what they did, and came to admire role models. And many of my role models were very working-class individuals who gave a lot to be able to remain active Mormons. And so I think I was one of those young people that got this sort of fervor of religiosity, and I was, as I talk in my memoir, I was into everything, and I was at church almost every night.
Right.
Interesting, however, that at the same time, going to high school, where there were rumblings of activism, that again, what helped me was that all of this Mormonism, all of these traits and things I was learning, made me a bit more articulate than a lot of kids in the barrio, made me better organized, gave me less fear of standing before groups or passing out pamphlets or flyers for the movement, or simply engaging in conversations. And so the interesting thing about my Mormonism is it evolved at the same time that I was evolving in terms of the consciousness of who I was, which was a Mexican-American in a predominantly Mexican-American school where so many of the limitations were very obvious. And so in some ways, if somebody said, how could you do that? Well, it's because they sort of grew together.
Right.
You know, and that, I think, helped me more so than if I had gone with one, predominantly one, you know, one view or one part of my life, but they sort of grew together.
Right.
And those issues that were sort of revolving around us in the west side of San Antonio were issues that I could explain through my religiosity. I could explain, at least in my limited mind, racism, discrimination, a sense of identity, the struggle for others. All of those I was defining both as a young high school kid, but also as a religious young man. So that coming together, the skills of the church, the commitments, I was the person that said, I will do this. I would do it.
Right.
And people began to say, yeah, he will. And so those skills helped me to get near to some of those who were the student leaders, even though I was not myself a student leader, but I was able to be mentored by them because I was a dependable guy. I was weird, this weird Mormon kid, but he's dependable and he's totally committed to this activism. And so, wow, you know, we got to keep them with us, was the kind of thing which served my purpose in learning.
You know, your comments about how the two identities really grew together is really fascinating and interesting to me. You know, reading you know, my academic career has had me read, right, a lot on the process of identity formation, and there are different analogies or scholars use to try to, you know, explain how identity forms. And a lot of them seem to insist, whether it's on this premise of there's like a series of concentric circles or there's some type of, foundation or, building analogy that one identity, and this isn't all scholars, but a number of things that I've found, a number of studies that I found or, kind of theories push that there's one identity comes to form like your basis, and in some ways that then other identities are then built on or added to or taken away from. Identity, of course, is a process. But generally, as I hear it explained, it begins with one thing and then it kind of, grows and moves on. And so it fascinates me about what you've, stated here is that these two seemingly, again, disparate identities or conflicting identities really, develop together. Both due to, your parents, but also the place, that the body you grew up in, and then those people that you're around you. So really it seems
the other thing, if I may interrupt, David, is that I also confronted the struggle within my Mormonism. That is, we were predominantly Mexican in my church, but we were connected to the larger church. And so many ways, some of the tensions and also some of the perceptions were based on my own relationship to the non-Mexican members. So, that was also bringing these two experiences of mine and bringing them into focus by having to deal with Mormonism outside the Latino or the Mexican church.
Mm-hmm. And, Mormonism, like many institutional religions, is viewed as, inherently and strictly patriarchal. However, in your, in your memoir, you mentioned that while, there are a number of, as in church lingo, we'd say, brethren or priesthood members that you looked up to and aspire to be like, there are also quite a bit of, female and sisters in the church that really were, very important and central in your process of your spiritual growth and your development. Could you talk a little bit about, just some of those women, some of those people, what they did for you, what they taught you?
Okay. Most, Latino or Mexicano or religious people, especially in groups that are smaller, were smaller among Mexican Americans, will probably resonate with this or can understand that women are such a big part of all Latino entities, especially before they become very structured and very rigid and centralized. And in my little church experience was, if the women did not do this, that we would not have a church. I mean, I remember the most important scriptorian in our congregation was a woman. And I remember that in one time some church sort of male leaders come to her and say, Sister Zacarias, can you explain this scripture for us? And to me, that was a very powerful thing. I also, in our youth program, we always had trouble keeping the men to lead, Mexicano men were struggling with their jobs and whatever. Mm-hmm. And men are men in church. And so seeing the sister take sort of over the youth program and make it run. And so I learned to see women as leaders quite early in my life. That their faith, their strength, the woman that got me reading, or the person who got me reading was a woman who, gave me my first novel. And when it was kind of embarrassing later on, and I talk about that in the memoir, I started becoming a reader. And what I found out later in doing some research on Mormonism among Latinos is how women held certain positions of authority that we don't have them today, and how they were so critical even in the early days of the church. And I was very much impacted. I also believed, and I always wanted to be this fire and brimstone preacher. Mm-hmm. For a time, I wanted to be a preacher. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be that I never did. I sort of took the more compassionate, I don't want to use the term nurturing because it has its wrong connotations, but I saw them strong without the fire and brimstone sermons. I saw them as leaders without having to have the title. And to me, again, that speaks to my own reality of being in service and providing leadership without necessarily the title. And I real leaders are those who are natural, who are organic. And what I saw in my growing up years was that the majority of the organic leaders were there. You know? And that has helped me. Now, you know, was I a great feminist, you know, at the time or whatever? No, but I never doubted that they could lead, and I never had a problem with women leading or instructing me or even chastising me, because I grew up in an environment in which women counseled me and women led me, and you know, and I learned from them. And so that was a wonderful experience, and I think sometimes I see that in Latino wards, and when that happens, these wards run better. And you know, when the men become rigid and a situation comes to centralize, I think sometimes women lose out in that. In fact, they do lose out in that.
Mm-hmm.
But so I had this privilege of growing up with powerful women. Of course, my mother was a powerful woman, and those who read my memoir will realize that my wife was also a quite powerful woman, and so I think that was very good for my learning.
Right, and thank you for talking about that. I wanted to keep the discussion moving as far as the memoir goes. So I wanted to move to the next site that is really, I think, central in your development here, and that's Vietnam. And although you state in the memoir that serving a mission, a Mormon mission, that is, would have been your first choice coming out of high school, that neither your second preference, which would have been the pursuit of a college education, neither of those worked out immediately after you graduated. So then enlisting in the Army at the time of, you know, Vietnam presented a way out of the barrio and also provided you with your first sustained experience of life beyond both the comfort and confinement of barrio life. So can you discuss a bit about your experiences, in Vietnam and how growing up in the barrio both, you know, helped you, but in other ways, so it prepared you in ways, but in other ways, you were completely unprepared for it. Of course, what you experienced beyond its confines.
Well, you know, the thing about it is that, you know, I wanted to see the world. There was this still part of this idea of transcending the barrio. I would come to appreciate, I was accumulating wonderful things about the barrio, but I would have to come back later, and we can talk about that later. But the Army was a great experience for a number of reasons. One, it did give me that sort of chance to go outside the barrio and eventually outside the United States. It also got me to the point where I was having to defend my two realities, being a Mexican-American, a Chicano, and being a Mormon. And that was not the place where either one of them, at least in my situations, was something that was quite popular. So I ended up having to defend myself as who I am, my sense of identity, and also living my moralities when I was very detached from the church. And I remember that, when I was out, I never really attended a white Mormon entity. And so I found that the few times that I had in my Army assignment, I was not near any place where there were Mormon congregations. And the first two times that I did, I found it totally awkward, and in a way, it forced me to say, what are your core values? So I think, in terms of saying this doesn't feel as welcoming as it should be, and part of it was my own reaction to it. I'm not trying to blame anybody. I just didn't feel the same sense of warmth that I had growing up in my own church.
Mm-hmm.
So I then had to say, well, am I Mormon or not? And so sort of double down on my beliefs, on my tradition as a Mormon, but also being challenged in the Army of whether I could maintain the sense of morality that I had developed as a young man. My story is not of someone who grows up religious and then leaves, but one this who grows up religious and fights like hell, if I use that word, to maintain himself within that. At the same time, I had to learn not to be judgmental, right, and to learn that the world was big and that it didn't necessarily function like I did, and that it didn't have to. And I remember the most religious, spiritual person I've ever met to this day was a Seventh-day Adventist, a young black soldier who taught me a lot about humility and not judgment, and also was the first one to point out that, Mormons had a tradition that some of their traditions, particularly related to African Americans, were not the best. And it was confronting to say, again, you're being challenged. How do you come to grips with it? And Vietnam was a place where, in many ways, I put all of my skills and learning from that Mormon church. I was efficient. I became immediately head of the emergency room and the dispensary where I worked. I organized. I stayed out of trouble, which that part of my morality helped me.
Right.
Because so many soldiers got into trouble with drugs, to get venereal disease for going out to the bars.
Mm-hmm.
They were inefficient. Vietnam was an incredible place of both in the positive and the inefficiency. Positive, I mean, as people grew up and took responsibility. So, and it also brought into my mind the questions of war and peace, and also the Vietnamese and how they were treated by the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to sort of look at that, and my own experience helped me to relate to these Vietnamese workers in our compound. There's so many things that were testing my own reality.
Mm-hmm.
of being Mormon and Chicano, and also expanding, because I really had to go beyond the Chicano bubble and beyond the Mormon bubble to be able to adequately apply those things that were dear to me in my life. And now they were expanded. View of both Mormonism and Chicanismo or Mexicanismo at the time. And I went through the first love there, which is a growing experience for anybody that remembers their first love of their life. And all of these things come into play. And so for me, it tested again my Mormonism and my identity as a Chicano. Even though, as I say in my memoir, there were moments when I would say, okay, I'm out of the barrio, I'm not a Chicano, I'm a man of the world,
Mm-hmm.
And to try to get this, because the world is very inviting in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy, and particularly Western thought, where you are not an ethnicity, you're an individual, you're a man. But at the same time, even those sort of thoughts and ambitions always collided with who I was. And so I would temper, and then I would find ways to bring it home, that is, expand who I was, but never leave the core values of that. And it taught me to be a leader. I had to be a leader. So there were a lot of positive things, while at the same time being so much against the war and seeing how much damage and wrong we were doing there.
Mm-hmm.
It created a sort of very conflicted view of American society.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was what both the Army and Vietnam did. I mean, you're thrusting this Mormon and Chicano kid into a war, and seeing the conflicts of African Americans, and seeing the conflicts of white soldiers pro and against the war, but seeing Vietnamese there, it was quite an experience to see that. And keeping journals, I think, helped me,
right?
Because I had to evaluate and constantly think about. I mean, as I read back, they sound so naive and ignorant and misguided at times, but they were important in the process of my own thinking.
Right.
I think. I think you can find, people can find a lot of things, and they can critique a lot of things about my mental process. Mm-hmm. But it was part of this, a chance to leave the barrio, but never the core values of who I was.
Right.
You know, both as a Mexican-American Chicano and a woman. And you know what? As a religious person, I think it was there where I realized that it was, there was something bigger than just my own religious denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was very valuable for me as I, when I would come back.
Right. And speaking of coming back, it seems that when you left Vietnam, it was a bittersweet experience. Why was that? It seems like you were leaving you almost felt maybe you were leaving a part of you in Vietnam, or there's, you know, there are things there, relationships you had there that you were sad to, right, have to leave. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, because you'd think initially that the reaction would be, right, the war's over and you know, as a soldier, you'd be excited. You get to return home and you're out of, you know, harm's way, perhaps. But it seemed a little bittersweet in reading those chapters. Could you talk about that?
Well, one of it was that I had been able to practice a sense of community, because I've always been, wherever I go, people see that. Sometimes even my colleagues here sort of get annoyed, because I'm so much into this sort of community and doing things with each other and camaraderie, and I'm very much about that. In war, sometimes, if you're in the right unit, will create the sense of camaraderie. I was useful. You know, I was coming out of high school and not going to college. You know, I had these sort of Western ideals of accomplishing, of succeeding, of doing something with my life that were still part of me. And here I was. I was leading man. I was being challenged as to whether I could deal with life or death situations, which something that I didn't have back in the barrio. I was having, you know, white men follow me, you know, where always was the difference in the barrio. You know, you're always following some white person. And so I think that was part of it. The other one was that I found a lot of things about myself. You know, I saw myself grew, and it was there that I decided that I wanted to write for a living, because I was always afraid that I was a terrible writer.
Mm-hmm.
I had terrible grammar and syntax when I left high school. And so I really sat there, you know what, I'm going to write. Now, I might have not written any better, but I was already, had already decided. And then, of course, I had found someone I was in love and understanding. And the beauty of that, which I have been blessed with, is that it was one of the first women that I would meet in my life who were bright, intelligent, courageous, and strong. And so meeting that person and seeing such tremendous strength was something that was just like, you know, it was amazing to me. And so I was leaving, you know, at the time, the love of my life, because of this, again, the Mormon thing. I was going to come back, I was going to serve a mission, and then come back, which in many ways was a very silly thing, because it was 2 years, you know, that I was going to leave this woman that I thought would be my wife forever. But again, I had this sort of Mormon struggle that I wanted to fulfill my role as a Mormon young man. And so all of these things, plus there's a certain attractiveness of war. You know, Robert E. Lee talks about that if war wasn't that horrible, it would be too attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Because of some of the things I described. And so so all of that was, and then I was coming back and I thought to myself, okay, what am I coming back to?
Mm-hmm.
I have no college degree. I have no big job. I'm going back to the barrio. I'm starting back from, I'm going back to step one.
Right.
At the moment, all of these things were coming to mind. I would appreciate that later, and you know, but at the moment, I felt like, okay, I'm being thrust back into the barrio with all the context, frameworks, and dynamics there of my relationship to the bigger world. While I was in the world and succeeding, I was there. goes back to Texas, particularly Texas, San Antonio. I'm going to be another Mexican in the barrio.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, when it was a lot of misguided thoughts, but those were very real to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so you came home. So you did. You came home and you returned to the barrio in San Antonio. And there, surprisingly, even though you had other plans of, as you mentioned, serving a Mormon mission and marrying, the love you had left behind in Vietnam, you actually ended up meeting and courting and marrying who actually became your wife, Alejandra, and then decided to, pursue your college education, which you did at Texas A&I University in Kingsville. So you make this move to Kingsville, which is still in Texas, but although this is a very different type of Texas, right? This is another Texas that you had very little preparation for. So could you talk about Kingsville as this, kind of this third site and, real place of significance where you are becoming and developing the person you are, both religiously and ethnically, and the challenges that you faced being a Chicano Mormon in Kingsville?
Well, I came to Kingsville, and of course, I had been accepted to the University of America's writing program, and to me, that was the perfect one. And then my wife said, we're pregnant, or I'm pregnant. Mm-hmm. And what is really interesting, and I mentioned in my memoir, even though we have been so incredibly adventurous in our life, this was the first time that we decided to play it very conservatively.
Right.
And so I accepted Texas A&I, and I went to Kingsville, Texas, a rural community, and, I got exposed to South Texas, which was different from, urban Texas or San Antonio, and it was a tremendous experience. There, three reasons. One was, this was my first experience when I went to Kingsville and went to a church that was sort of integrated,
mm-hmm.
where I ended up being in conflict directly and strongly with some of my white brothers and sisters,
mm-hmm.
where I was looked upon by conservative leadership, except for my bishop, who was actually quite liberal, but everyone else and the higher structures, as being some student radical, because I became active in the Chicano movement. And so it was the first time that I confronted that institutionally. Other times there had been, thoughts, ideas, I knew it was there, but it was there in Kingsville, where again I had to question my faith and wonder, do I believe in this enough to put up with this kind of challenge? But it also taught me, and I didn't appreciate it fully until I left, that I had to be more open about who I congregate with, and that
mm-hmm.
people of faith don't all necessarily think alike, and people of faith can also be nasty sometimes.
Right.
And we can hurt each other. And of course, I was naive. I had this notion that all good religious people will hear the message of compassion and civil rights and whatever, and jump into it and say, hurrah, hurrah, let's go.
Yeah.
I learned that there were great people. They happened to be very conservative politically, in a very divided community. And so It was a real challenge to my, again, core values. What do you believe in? How much are you willing to abide by them despite the tensions? The other thing is that Kingsville was fantastic because the Chicano movement was in its heyday in Kingsville.
Mm-hmm.
And much of what I was introduced to, the Chicano scholars, particularly people like Octavio Romano, as we were reading his material, who was one of the Chicano intellectuals, or one of the precursors intellectually of the movement, allowed me to look at my own life experience and make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew there was discrimination. I knew that we were struggling. I knew there were things. But he helped me understand, through reading his material, what it all meant. And in a funny way, because he was such a strong advocate of one's identity and culture, that it made me reaffirm both my Chicano and my Chicano Mormon culture, and got me. And so while I was estranged to a certain extent from the local congregation, in fact, was sort of not active for a whole year, it replaced some of that. So as I talk in my memoir, you know, the political meetings at night sort of replaced the firesides I used to go in church. Mm-hmm. The pastel lighting for the La Raza Unida party sort of made up for the lack of missionary proselyting that I could have been doing, or home teaching, or that kind of stuff.
Right.
But in the process, you know, sometimes we talk about how our identity is maintained not only by what we do, but how people react to us.
Right, right.
And so my Mormonism was again being called into question, and whether I could be a good Chicano activist as a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I set out to prove that I did, and in doing so went back and reaffirmed that, yes, these things I do and these things I don't do. Forced me again to look at what I wanted to believe, how I wanted to be, what kind of person I wanted to be. And so I got to know many of the leaders in the Chicano movement, both in the local and sort of national level. And got to understand that whenever we learn something or are confronted by something, we pick and choose. Now, that, mm-hmm. that's not always good for the political party or for the ideologues, but that's what most of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And so confronting the two challenges again in such a way made me begin to choose that which I loved about my Chicanismo and that which I loved about my Mormonismo, and then which I didn't. And defined in a way that earlier experience had not, to becoming was, you know, the sense of service, the sense of commitment, these things that I evolved, because I had to live them both in conjunction with some activists and also against the grain. You know, I remember one time when we were campaigning, and this fellow that I was with, we were driving, and he would stop and tear down signs from the opposition. And I would say, that's not who I want to be.
Right.
I believe in what I'm promoting, but I have to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
I have to sell it on its own merit. And there were things about what helped me. Again, that Mormon discipline. I stayed up to 3 in the morning putting out the underground paper while people stayed. I didn't wither under a fire. I read what I was supposed to do. I accomplished my tasks. All of these things came out of that sort of body of Mormonism that I had developed.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me, I think, a good activist. It also got me in trouble later on when some people turned against me. And part of it was I was a faithful adherent of the Raza Unida Party at the time and the Chicano movement. And and then, of course, Kingsville was a small university. It was not particularly hard, and so it gave me a time to, to do a lot of things solidify my relationship with my wife, who was there. And as I mentioned, she had been an old union activist. You wouldn't imagine seeing her, small, petite little woman, but she had some great insights. We used to share that. We would sit there to the middle of the night talking about the kind of people we wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, again, avoiding all those self-destructive sort of behaviors that one can learn in college. And that helped me. I mean, I made a lot of mistakes. I learned a lot about commitment and leadership from people there that I never thought I would. And again, another dose of don't be a critic, don't be judgmental. People are people. You can love them. And that was a place where I had people who I thought truly loved me as a person. And yet they didn't have my, you know, my own religious values. And I came to appreciate that quite a bit. So Kingsville was a great place. And knowing Tejanos from South Texas was a real eye-opening experience.
Right.
You know, they were much more firm in what they believed there and in fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was amazing to me. You know, so it and I think that's where I learned that I wanted to be a historian, but I took the journalism degree, and I really wanted to do theater, but I didn't get accepted to graduate school, and so my dreams of again producing Chicano plays in Broadway which sort of went down the drain.
Right.
Because I think sometimes accomplishing dreams and not accomplishing other ones can teach us a lot about our reality in this world.
Certainly. No, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And I appreciate you so much sharing about your time in Kingsville. We're running short on time, but I had two more questions before we wrap up. One of them has to do, you mentioned this a few times throughout the book, that Mormon leaders tend to teach their membership that they are to live in the world but not be of the world. Can you talk about how you've interpreted this admonition throughout your life? And again, you've mentioned in some ways how this has affected your activism and scholarship, but can you address how you've interpreted this personally and tried to instill it?
Well, I think being in the world and not of it means for me to be a participant, to care about those around me, to care about what things are happening, to engage in the world, and sometimes engaging in the world is getting your hands dirty. It's messy, it's complicated, it's contradictory. But the notion to me is that by living in the world, by being with others, you learn from them, and you learn to be compassionate about
right.
people
mm-hmm.
and not to be so judgmental, and to realize that sometimes people do the best they can and still things don't go well. But to not be of the world is a part where it helped me to keep from being sucked in to sometimes what I think are secular ideas, whether it's frustration, anger, whether it's a misguided reaction, because I think that if you're a person, at least for me as a religious Mormon, is that I have to look at those things that I consider eternal characteristics and values, that something that my maker wanted me. And so at the moments when I was either in La Raza Unida or where I was in the army, and when I was trying to solve problems and making decisions, I always try to ask myself, is this an eternal perspective? Is this a perspective that transcends the temptation to make a decision or to take an action that in itself does not transcend where you're at? Now, sometimes you have to do that to be in the world, of course. But it was always the idea that I was not excused from being part of my community, part of my world, that I had to live in it. But it was also not an excuse to say, well, I'm so angry that this is what I do, or I'm so overwhelmed by materialism or success that I'm going to follow this route. So it is meant to be tense, to be complicated, and to navigate. So I am in the world. I do things because they are the reality of my life. But
right.
I have to transcend them in the way I live my life and in the way that I think and in the solutions that I find. And that was, to me, when you try to live that, you want to refine yourself at least to the capacity you can, right? And not everybody's religious, so they may not understand it. But I would put in the context, if someone that has great ideals, and then faces normal problems. Is that person, by being in the world and not being of it, means that they will be firm to their ideals, at the same time engage in the messiness of life.
Right.
And sometimes
exactly.
Mm-hmm. That stretches your moral concepts, and it should. And sometimes you come out of it. My view is that if there is a heaven, which I hope there is, otherwise I spend a lot of time preparing for it. But if there is, then I'm going to be battered and scarred when I get there. I'm not going to be nice and clean and well-pressed. That's my view
right.
of the eternal kind of life. And so that's how I try to deal with that.
Great. That's I think you put it very succinctly and at the same time eloquently, you know, particularly in, as, you know, you mentioned to those that may be not religious, it's about of maintaining, you know, some type of character and moral or ethics, whatever it is, and having that be your constant and drive you, where you continue to engage with those around you and build relationships. And as you mentioned frequently, build communities and rather as opposed, because, you know, the other, you know, the other side to that is, well, you isolate yourself from the world, right? And some religious people do interpret, you know, that admonition to be isolationists, if you will, kind of gather the wagons around themselves, or maybe they're, you know, their particular family, and kind of think, well, we're going to kind of keep ourselves strong and let the world go the way it is. But really that admonition is quite the reverse, right? It's to engage with the outside and to both hopefully have some, you know, be influenced and influence, you know, both influence others and have them influence you, you know, with the good that you have and the good that they have. So thanks so much for summing that up for us and sharing that. Lastly, before we wrapped up, I wanted to ask you actually what it is that you're working on now. You completed this memoir. You've written, I think, seven, if I have the count right, you know, scholarly works of historical works and monographs. So what's your next project?
Well, I'm doing two things. One is I'm going back and I'm reworking my first book and going from a history of La Raza Unida Party, which sort of transcends. It's a work that attempted to say a lot about the Chicano movement, to actually coming back and writing. And I always thought this for years, that I would come back and write my definitive, not the definitive work, but my definitive work on the Chicano movement, mm-hmm. taking a lot of new scholarship and having the time years later to go back and to look at that period of time and to give it a sense of depth and also to be able to explain it to a whole new generation of Chicanos and even Latinos about what that era was and how it was a part of this continuity of struggle, mm-hmm. So that's going to be, I think, the final scholarly work that I do. At the moment, however, I am finishing off. I was asked if I would be willing to do a screenplay of my last book, When Chicanos Could Play Ball, and it has been fascinating because I've always believed that you got to step out of your box periodically to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And you appreciate those who actually do it all the time. Plus, it makes your mind grow. And so I'm having a lot of fun.
Wow.
I hope my department chair doesn't hear this. Just kidding. But I'm having a lot of fun because what it is I'm learning a new genre and appreciating the fact that in film, you try to tell the same message, but in a different way, and sometimes with different characters. So it's been very interesting because, as a historian, I always hate these adaptations. I'm the first one to point out that's not historically
right.
correct. That's totally and
people hate watching movies and plays with historians now because of that.
Right. So it's been interesting. It's been interesting, and it's kind of and maybe it's my way to come back and spite those. People that made a decision not to accept me into a theater program, you know,
maybe
sort of hidden thought that I would get back and prove to them that I can write. So,
right.
But it's been fun during the summer. I've been doing research for the other, but spending some mornings doing that. And I do plan to follow up with some other works, but I think the biggest scholarly work is going to be to revisit and bring in all the new material and re-interview some people, mm-hmm. 30 years later and how they feel. And so my original work was United We Win.
Right.
This one, tentatively, it may not stay there, is United We Won. And to talk about it, I think there's this sense that the movement failed,
right.
And there's a lot of very pessimistic, and of course things have not totally changed, and of course some things have gotten worse. But if we don't appreciate our struggles, then we end up reinventing things. And so my thought is to a new generation to say, yes, things are bad, and yes, you should struggle, but look at this. And appreciate that, and then go on and do your struggle. And so that's my work, and hopefully in some ways I also bring the story of people of faith within the Chicano movement and how critical they were, and to understand their faith, not just the political way, but also in terms of how it was transcending, but they were living in the world while not being of it.
Right.
And so that's part of this grandiose dream to sort of my last work.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing information on those two projects. Both of them sound fascinating. And again, thank you for coming on to New Books in Latino Studies and sharing your time with us and talking about your memoir, Chicana While Mormon. I encourage our listeners to go out and get the book and read it, or encourage your libraries to stock it and share it with others. So, Ignacio, thanks again for your time.
Thank you very much, David.
Thanks for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with Ignacio M. Garcia, author of the new memoir, Chicano While Mormon, Activism, War, and Keeping the Faith, published by Fairleigh Dickinson University Press in 2015. If you'd like to get a copy of the book, you may do so by following our link to Amazon on the page. Also, if you'd like to reach us, you can send us an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you.